The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly with me, Alex Kratosky, this week on the show.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to E3. Let me start by welcoming the fans here with us in Los Angeles and the millions of fans watching us around the world.
E3 2014 is in full swing, and I'll be talking to Guardian Games editor Keith Stewart about the highlights of this year's Gaming Expo. Also, I'll be joined by Alex Hearn and Charles Arthur to discuss a momentous landmark in AI, the first computer to pass the Turing test. Or is it? We celebrate the power of social media in zero-G as the first Vine from space returns to Earth, and a hotly anticipated and much-hyped software release that took 54 years to get to us. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome, Charles.
Hello.
Welcome, Alex.
Hello.
This week, let's kick off the show with a milestone in computer-generated artificial intelligence. Alex, a team of computer scientists this week announced that their AI had managed to pass the Turing game, or Turing test, as it's more widely known. What's the Turing test?
So the Turing test is kind of an idea that was thought up by computing pioneer, really, Alan Turing, 65 years ago. It's the idea for a game that he suggested could be used to tell whether or not computers, machines in general, had reached some level of human competence. The idea was simple. It's if you have a conversation with two people over essentially what we now know as instant messaging, and you can't tell which of them is the computer and which of them is a person, then computers have reached that milestone.
So that's a milestone. That doesn't necessarily mean intelligence, because in fact, what people often think about the Turing test and other related tests that we'll talk about in a second is that this is a representation of the fact that computers have reached the same intelligence as human beings, and therefore they're about to surpass us and take over the world and make us their robot slaves.
And even in the 1950 paper where Turing described this test, he suggests other ways that we might be able to tell instead that computers have reached human levels of cognition. My favorite one is chess, which of course they already reached 15 years ago.
That's right, with Deep Blue.
So this is one possible way of guessing whether or not computers are human level. Since then, a lot of stuff has come out with people suggesting that actually, one thing that we think of as what it means to be human involves our relationship to the physical world. So the way we interact with each other over text messages can never fully convey human cognition, because human cognition also involves being able to manipulate objects, being able to look at things and tell what they are just by sight or sound, and that simple understanding of text is necessarily only ever a subset of humanity.
So we've talked a bit about the controversy surrounding this particular winner. Tell me actually some of the details about the winner and who was involved.
Well, so the winner is simulating a 13-year-old boy called Eugene Goostman. Eugene was created by a team from St. Petersburg, Russia, led by Vladimir Veselov. And basically, there's a nice trick at the heart of it, which is why they won. The idea is, if one of the first things your chatbot says is that they are a 13-year-old boy who speaks English as a second language, you're a lot more forgiving of odd little quirks and peccadilloes in their speech. And so you've got a natural leg up on winning the Turing test. And that seems to be the big advantage they had at this event, which was held at the Royal Society in conjunction with the University of Reading and Professor Kevin Warwick, who we all know from such things as implanting a chip in his arm.
So are there other tests or there are other competitions that are trying to deal with this question of computer or artificial intelligence?
Yeah, I mean, the big difference is the way they apply this general schema that Turing thought up. It's the fact that it was thought up by Alan Turing means that it's always going to dominate discussions in this way. But at least in the 1950 paper, Turing didn't really go into much detail about what this test entailed. He suggests later on that he kind of thought by about the year 2000 that maybe 30% of people would be fooled in 5-minute conversations. But it's pretty clear that that wasn't meant to be taken as absolute. This is when computers will be as good as people. So some people since then have tried to sit down and make a much more rigorous test, going, well, you know, if we are going to take this as a guide to human-robot cognition, what would we actually need? And the biggest one of that is the Loebner Prize, which has been held every year since 1991, I think. And the conversations are longer than 5 minutes. They're with more people. They're over a wider range of topics. And also, every year, they don't give out the gold medal or even the silver medal. The winner of the Loebner Prize each year gets $4,000 and the bronze medal. The silver medal is reserved for a machine which can actually convince a majority of judges. And the gold medal, they haven't even started testing for yet. The gold medal is reserved for a machine which can convince a majority of judges it's human when it answers questions on auditory and visual input as well. They don't even bother testing with that because we've not come close to something which can sit down and watch an episode of Downton Abbey and tell you about the plot and what one of the characters is thinking. Like, but that is a fairly basic level of human understanding.
Then again, there's a fair number of humans who'd have trouble with that sometimes,
quite.
I think.
You know. My favourite description that came out of all of this was just a very simple one. A computer that can sit down and watch an episode of The Simpsons and tell you when to laugh. We are unimaginably far from that right now. That involves so many different aspects of cognition which we just can't model.
Speaking as a parent, I've got to say that's quite a difficult thing which you almost have to teach your children. You know, yeah. there are so many I've had to sort of explain, okay, this thing here in the Simpsons, this is a reference to. What does a reference to mean? Well, a reference is where there's something that exists already. So, you know, this is a reference to this film Inception, which you haven't seen because you're too young to see it. But anyway, this is and it's stuff like that. I mean,
yeah,
that's an incredibly complicated one, you know, watch the Simpsons. But I think there's a deeper question in this, which is that a lot of the things that people are saying, well, this is a test to see if a computer is lucky, are that they're sort of looking at outputs rather than processes. And the question is, are we actually interested in the outputs or the processes? When it comes to beating people at chess, yeah, computers do it. But they don't do it because they think through better than people do. They just blitz through all the possible moves and get there. Whereas humans do it by paring down very rapidly between all the choices they have of moves and trying the ones that work best. And it's interesting that computers are no good, or that they're not as good at least. Certainly can't beat good professionals at the game of Go, which is a Chinese game which depends on a greater feel for patterns, for subtle ideas like something. There's an idea called thickness and lightness, and it's very complicated even to explain. But also, you know, what are we talking about when we talk about cognition? If you sort of say at a dinner party, you say, and then we stop the M6 services, and across there's a husband sitting across the table from his wife, and he says, the M6 services, and winks at his wife. What has been said there? You know, so that's something where that he has to understand that she knows something and they have to have shared cognition. Whereas a computer that says something to you has no idea of what the cognition is, what it's actually transferring to you in saying something. And that's the emptiness behind this whole Turing test thing, is that the bot has no idea what it's actually talking to you about.
Thank you very much. Would you write that down and I'll say Alex's manifesto when it comes to artificial intelligence, Charles. That was absolutely beautiful. In fact, that is a good introduction to cognitive psychology. And in fact, I may have even posed this question on this very podcast in the past. But Charles, who would you have as part of your brain team who's coming up with an artificial intelligence? Who would you make sure would be on the panel that would contribute? You mentioned, you know, you're a parent, and so therefore you can see it in your children and how they have to learn. You've been speaking about cognitive psychology. You know, what other types of people would you have on your panel?
Actually, a comedy writer would be a useful person to have there, because when you're writing comedy, you have to be able to see how other people will see things, and that's all part of it. And I guess, yeah, there are loads of really interesting people doing interesting stuff with deep learning neural networks, which is a huge emerging subject that we'll come onto, I think, in future weeks. But wow, if I was trying to assemble a panel of people to do artificial intelligence, I'd probably say, well, I shouldn't be on it to start with, and smarter people should be. Sort of, you know, it's a really hard thing. But I think a lot of the stuff that people focus on is so much about outputs and not about what actually is the underlying stuff and is there value in the underlying stuff.
And Alex, would you have smarter or dumber people than Charles on the panel?
Well, one of the things that came out of this for me is that you need a fair few people with absolutely no sense of humour. The transcripts of previous conversations that this year's winner went through show that some people kind of approach it with a bit too much fun. These chatbots are brilliant if you do speak to them, you know, and have a fun back and forth conversation, answer their questions, they answer yours. But when you just start going, hello chatbot, what is your name? Eugene. Hello, how do you spell that? How do I spell what? How do you spell your name? Eugene. Right. How do you spell that? And, you know, they will just get caught in loops. All you need is a slightly inquisitive mind and you can break them. They are, at the current stage, they're fun toys. And I kind of think if we want to get further, we need someone who sits down and goes, that's not good enough. We need something which has, you know, conception of objects, which can refer back to previous conversations in a way that's not just this cheap trick focused on outcomes, but which actually tries to mimic speech by thinking about what speech means.
I think they should have all these chatbots and just set them free on Twitter. You know, give each one of them an account. Don't say that it is. And just, you know, see how they go. And I think that would be a great way of finding out which ones are and which aren't. And, you know, which ones can stay the course. Let them go a year. See if one of them becomes a, you know, a sort of a million follower sort of thing because of their witty repartee.
There was actually a study released just today which showed that from zero, the average human Twitter user gets its followers much, much slower than the average bot Twitter user does.
Well, there you go. And if you have any ideas about who you would have on your fantasy AI panel, then do let us know at technology@theguardian.com. For more on our coverage of this story and everything in AI, head to theguardian.com/technology. This week, we saw another glimpse of space as NASA's astronaut Reid Wiseman captivated us gravity-beleaguered ground dwellers with the very first Vine from the ISS. Now, NASA has a record of doing pretty well on social media, tweeting from 230 miles above us. Alex, why does NASA get it so right?
This is a remarkably unmagical answer, but I think part of it is because they've got this quite helpful rule set down from above, which is that any material they create is public domain. So NASA has a huge wealth of stuff which is already public, and it gets over the sort of institutional hurdles of secrecy that you get in private companies. There's not really anything against speaking to the public because everything they do, the public can already see. So why not have a Twitter account sharing your beautiful pictures? Why not have a Twitter account talking about what your robot is actually doing that day on Mars? Why not do the same thing on Facebook, on Vine? Why not give your astronauts cameras? Everyone already has access to this information. So,
and of course, it's space, so everybody's really excited about it as well.
And everyone cares. The same sort of constraints probably apply to the US Department of Transport, but no one really wants to see all of the pictures they produce.
And NOAA as well, the National Oceanic and... Yeah.
Exactly. Whereas space is space, and space is awesome, and so everyone cares.
Yeah. So Charles, actually, we've had some good examples in the past of NASA and other space agencies being very cool up there. Mm. Give me a rundown. When was the first? What was the first social media experience in space?
So the first one, to the best of our knowledge, is Mike Massimino, who was the first astronaut to tweet from space in May 2009, when Twitter itself was only, 3 years old, is that?
I do quite like to the best of our knowledge, as though there may have been a secret tweeter from space using a pseudonym, just not really telling anyone.
No, you know somebody up there had a MySpace account, yeah, right? Yeah, and they were decorating their homepage.
Yeah, something like that. I mean, you know, maybe Mike Massimino had someone actually doing it for him on the ground. You know, maybe he didn't actually have his smartphone or computer up there. Then there was, of course, the wonderful Chris Hadfield.
Magnificent.
Who is pub quiz question a Canadian?
He is. He certainly. Yeah, he wasn't with NASA, actually.
No, that's right. He was in the International Space Station. So he did the fantastic Space Oddity video in 2013 and gained pretty much, you know, 50,000 followers every time he went around the Earth. His Twitter following is just gigantic, and I'm sure it helped sell his book, which is great, actually. It's a fantastic book. There was Instagram.
Other books are available,
though none by Chris Hadfield, as far as I know. There was Instagram from space in 2014, live webcam from the ISS about a month ago.
Have you seen that? Have you seen the live webcam from space?
Does it show the Earth?
It shows the Earth sometimes, and sometimes it shows. It is the coolest thing ever. It literally is. It's just like, space. Wow. Well, wow, that's yeah. that's a live. You know, in the past, you remember when the first live webcams? It was like here's the parking lot of a supermarket.
And
here's
still log on. And watch
yeah, exactly.
Anyway.
Here's a coffee pot. Here's yeah. a coffee pot. Exactly. Now here's the Earth from space. Like, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, it's just the Earth, though, isn't it? And of course, in really extraplanetary activity, there's the Mars Curiosity rover, which tweeted away from Mars, and which actually, on a former edition of this program, I believe that we actually did some of Curiosity's tweets, and as it got more and more tired, it got
slower. Oh, we did. That was Phoenix. Curiosity's still up there, still happily tweeting.
Oh, okay.
And it has its own parody accounts as well. So sarcastic Curiosity rover.
But is this, I mean, you said, Alex, that, you know, this is by the nature of the US government saying, yeah, go for it, have a good time, scientific organization, everything's public domain. Is this something that is remarkable? Are they doing it right? And what can other institutions learn?
Yeah, no, they're absolutely doing it right. I think they have more advantages than just, you know, this radical transparency set in by law or everything's public domain. They also just have a hugely passionate group of people working for them. You really get the sense every time you see anything to do with NASA, anytime you speak to anyone involved with it, they all love space. And there's no risk in giving... You're not going to have the risk of a disgruntled employee going wild on the Twitter account and badmouthing them, because they all love space and NASA is about space. And why would they badmouth it? Because it's NASA and it's awesome. And when you have that sort of infectious enthusiasm running all the way through, you can kind of just open the floodgates and let your employees all do your public relations for you.
Well, you can follow our obsession with space and everything to do with this story at theguardian.com/technology. In software development, there are always delays. But web pioneer Ted Nelson has taken the delay to new depths. Earlier this year, he finally released Xanadu, the publishing software that has taken him 54 years to launch, and it was released with little fanfare. In fact, he's let everyone have a go, launching Open Xanadu as well, but nobody noticed really until this week. Regardless, I spoke with Ted Nelson back in 2012 when he was really excited about the launch of Xanadu then. And I started by asking him, why the name?
Well, the name, of course, comes from the Coleridge poem, which, of course, was a poem about the original Xanadu, which is actually a place about 300 kilometers north of Beijing, which was the summer palace of the Emperor Kublai Khan, as described by Marco Polo. Then Coleridge read the Marco Polo stuff and, in an opiate trance, apparently, wrote Kublai Khan, and that is considered the most romantic poem in the English language. And then he was interrupted, he says, in his reveries and in writing down his poem by a person from Porlock who made him forget. And so to me, this name symbolized the magic place of literary memory where nothing would be forgotten, and so I've stuck with it.
I like that, but now it's evolved.
Oh, yeah, well, but it's really had the same form since 1979 when I got together with a very brilliant team of eccentric geniuses, and we essentially worked out the structure, and we were so far ahead that we worked out elaborate optimizations. Now, one of the rules of the computer world is premature optimization is very dangerous because you don't know what part you should optimize. And so we got lost in brilliant technicalities, and then we got backing, and then another team got lost in other brilliant technicalities, and by then it was 1992 and they'd wasted $5 million and I had no say over it. So I got the name back and have been endeavoring since 1992 to bring forth a much simpler version that will work in today's systems.
So Alex, the project got lost in optimizations. Is this the curse of Xanadu, as Wired magazine said in 1995? So many coders, so many idealists. Is Nelson right or is he a lunatic?
So the basic idea behind Xanadu is kind of cool. It's I mean, you have to go way back and think about what it was like when the whole idea was suggested in 1960, when the project was launched. There was no World Wide Web. There wasn't really even a worldwide internet. There was a loose connection of networked computers. So we're talking about something which is an alternative conception for how the entire internet could have built up. It's just the entire internet was built before it was launched. At its root, it's vaguely similar to the World Wide Web. There's actually even shared metaphors in common. The word hypertext, which is the HT in HTTP, that was coined by Ted Nelson to refer to basically links that you can click on. But where the World Wide Web was very much about a thoroughly disconnected network of servers where a link points to another server, but what's hosted on that server is there, and what's hosted on your server is there, and what's hosted on your server is yours, and links are one way, and if you click and go out, then that new server is a whole new domain. Xanadu was much more about trying to sort of reinvent the whole of publishing for this new networked world. So links were bidirectional. If you clicked on something, that link would feed back to the server that you clicked it from. Material could be pulled in from a link as well as sending the user back out. But then you start getting that and you start going, but wait, there's issues like copyright here. In the end, Xanadu required, Nelson's aim for Xanadu required a complete reinvention of the copyright system. A link, putting something on the internet, would be seen as letting someone use it for a set fee, which was all built into the protocol, and the payment for it was all built into the protocol, and he basically had to reinvent not only just, you know, how the World Wide Web works, which these days is quite an ask in itself, but you have to reinvent how the banking system works to let people make these micro payments whenever they link. You have to reinvent how politics works to check. And so it was an absurdly idealistic project, but maybe one which isn't going to replace the browser anytime soon.
It's interesting then that we're paying attention to this in the week that European Court of Justice said that publishing a link doesn't automatically infringe on copyright. And certainly had Xanadu been the model through which we publish online, then that would have been a very clear infringement of copyright.
Actually, of course, what this European Court ruling shows is that maybe the best answer would have just been to publish Xanadu and let the courts catch up. If there's anything, any theme running through the history of the web, it's that if something is illegal when you make it and you get enough people using it and relying on it, it will probably be legal eventually, because courts move slowly, governments are even slower, and when people like something, they like it, and it's really hard to take it away from them.
So Charles, give me a bit of background on Ted Nelson, because what Alex has explained is that he's, you know, the man that people know invented the word hypertext, and, you know, was part of the scene of people who were playing around with ideas of how to create a publishing system using this brand new network. But who is the man, the myth, the legend?
Well, he's one of the sort of the formative people from the 60s, the 70s. He came up with the idea of the mouse, of the whole the whole way that you would interact with machines in a different way rather than through teletypes. So he had a sort of a broader vision of a sort of connected computers, really, at a time when computers weren't really connected. But yeah, he basically got sort of caught down the cul-de-sac, I think, really, of the whole Xanadu idea, which I suppose, given the name, is sort of ironic, yeah. Isn't it? You know, this sort of non-existent kingdom. And so in that sense, he becomes both a great inventor with the hypertext idea, but also a sort of a footnote, which is a sad way to end up, I guess.
And Alex, how does Open Xanadu and Xanadu relate to the web? What now? Like, has it been released? Has it finally been realized?
So obviously Xanadu these days is not going to be a complete replacement for the web. It's something that sits on top of it. The release of Open Xanadu actually just runs in the web browser. The way Nelson seems to be conceptualizing it these days is as something which can compete with PDFs, as a way of presenting documents that doesn't just recreate what you have on paper on a screen, but which is built from the ground up for a networked society. So the great document that shows off Open Xanadu is an essay with quotes in from other works like the King James Bible and other things on interface management. But those quotes, you click through, or because it's not actually built for the mouse, you hit space and you go through. And the entire King James Bible is there linked to from the quote. So you can bounce from a quoted passage into where it sits in its source document, back out. You can continue reading the source document, hit another quote, read it in its original context. It's great. But at the same time, possibly doesn't need 54 years of development behind it.
It sounds an awful lot like some of the academic databases and systems that are out there for sharing PDFs and exactly. notes and existing work. So is it, I mean, have we got to a point where a new paradigm is unnecessary? Should we just give in and say, hey, man, we like the web, we like PDFs?
I think we might have reached the point where the web is so, so entrenched that it will always be easier to jury-rig a system on top of it that does whatever you want than it is to build something from the ground up that makes it work better. And you're seeing that everywhere. So, for instance, you know, Tor might have been nice if one day the web had been built on that, because, you know, then you'd have greater guarantees of privacy and secrecy. But it's not. And so people don't seem to be moving wholesale to browsing through the Onion router. And then at the other end, you know, you could have a lovely distributed hosting paradigm where everyone uses something like BitTorrent to host websites. But again, that's a lot of effort. So instead, we just run caching software and we try and get around blocks that way. The web's probably here to stay, isn't it, really?
I don't know. It's just a passing fad, really, isn't it? Charles, what do you imagine something like Xanadu could be used for?
God, I've got to say, I've got no idea. I think it is one of those things that sort of is filling a gap that doesn't exist. Although I think that the thing about, you know, the web is really, really entrenched. I think that's quite a desktop-centric view of the world, and, you know, in its way, Xanadu is rather. I mean, if you look at things that are happening on mobile, where you have, you know, all the messaging services, the WhatsApps, the WeChats, the Lines, the Vibers, all those, you know, iMessage, even, you know, the way that Apple's going to change it in iOS 8, where you'll be able to put short lapse video, short lapse audio in it, as well as text and pictures and stuff. I think that, you know, that's not the web. There's no URL where those things exist. So I think that we're actually moving to, with mobile, we're moving to a space where it's sort of post-web or super-web or supra-web or infra-web or something, where it's sort of none of the above. And I mean, you know, I don't think Xanadu fits into that either, but we are definitely creating new ways of doing group interactions that aren't the web, but which aren't either in that old paradigm. You know, they're just evolving, but evolving really fast.
Listen to the whole interview that I did with Ted Nelson in our archive. There will be a link on our blog. And read more of Alex's impressions of the finished product at theguardian.com/technology. Cue hyperbole, expensive light shows, pumped up presentations, booth babes, and a full array of bad casual wear. Yeah, it's that time of year again when the good and the great of the games world fly into Los Angeles for the E3 bonanza of computer gaming and gaming tech. Keith Stewart is The Guardian's games editor, and he's been on the ground covering it for us and slightly bleary-eyed as he joined us on the line now. Good morning, Keith.
Good morning.
Oh, you sound wonderful, Keith. You don't sound asleep at all.
Well, thank you. It's the typical E3 story of failed hotel Wi-Fi and lots of conferences happening one after the other in downtown Los Angeles, and trying to run from, it's a kind of a rat run of games journalists around downtown LA. So yes, it's been the usual E3 story, a mix of kind of predictability and chaos.
Well, actually, you say it's, you know, a bunch of games journalists, but this is a consumer event. So are you ducking and diving through hordes and hordes of consumers, of people baying to get their hands on the first of a thing?
Well, it's actually, I mean, E3 is a kind of relic in it. It's actually still a trade show. So the audience here is kind of made up of journalists, developers, bloggers. It's very much still, E3 is kind of a snapshot of what the industry was a decade ago. Lots of really, really heavily invested, mostly young men, obsessing over kind of familiar brands and franchises. So yeah, it doesn't kind of look outwards like other industry events do now. You know, if you look at something like GDC or South by Southwest or Game City in Nottingham, those are very much embracing the public, whereas E3 is still very much, hello, this is a boys club, please leave us alone to play our 30-hour RPGs.
But people focus so much time and energy on E3, getting their games ready for E3, going to E3 to make sure that, you know, they can get coverage for back home, all kinds of I don't know, hysteria surrounds E3. Historically, it really has felt like the gaming event in the English-speaking calendar.
This is definitely where the likes of Activision, Ubisoft, Sony and Microsoft speak to the kind of inveterate veteran gamer, the audience that's always been there since the 70s. This is very much big boxed copy Christmas releases. So, you know, the big games that we've seen so far, things like Uncharted 4, Far Cry 4, Assassin's Creed Unity, Call of Duty Advanced Warfare, and these are the kind of giants of the traditional industry, and that's why I think what happens at E3 is that these companies have got to really get those early adopters, the hardcore base on board, so then they can spend the rest of the year telling their relatives and friends who aren't so immersed in the games industry, hey, these are the really big brands and these are the things that are really exciting us. So yeah, this is very much about pushing those big franchise sequels. And this year has been kind of strange in that it's very nostalgic. Like one of the big announcements at Microsoft's press conference was the return of Crackdown, which is a big open world game from the Xbox, which was released in 2007 originally, I think. And at Sony, one of the big things was the reboot of Grim Fandango, which I'm sure,
oh
Alex, you remember,
gosh,
was like a
I
big
do.
A point and click adventure.
Oh my gosh, you literally just gave me chills.
We always think of games as being really forward looking, but this E3 has been really nostalgic. And Grim Fandango was one of the biggest cheers at the Sony conference. People have such a fondness for that game and have a fondness for that era because it was an era in which games were really challenging, were really funny, were really idiosyncratic, whereas everybody loves the stuff like Forza Horizon 2 and Far Cry 4 and GTA 5 now, obviously, but there is that sense, that longing for what games used to be, that certainty about what games were and what games are, and I think, you know, the industry is in a sort of a quandary, a fear about what the future holds. At the Sony conference last night, they announced that the free-to-play games would be available on PlayStation 4. And obviously free-to-play is a business model which has come in from smartphones. And it's kind of really worried the industry. They're thinking, we've got to embrace this, but how do we do it? Because our hardcore base hates the idea of free-to-play. They see it as a kind of some sort of con trick. So, and it was fascinating at the Sony conference last night when they announced, wait, we're going to have free-to-play games now. Honestly, you could have heard a pin drop. It was utter silence.
Yeah, we're going to have games that use a joystick to you. You know, that kind of thing, isn't it? It's almost like it's an expected now. Now, you've been talking about how E3 is, you know, the big boys. It's all about the lights. It's about the people who have a heck of a lot of money, who are pumping out those boxed games that you're going to get for quite a lot of money at Christmas time, or, you know, whichever holiday of your choice. Is there any room for the indies? Is there any room for the small fry? How can somebody like an independent studio that's creating really interesting and innovative games actually make a noise, actually make a dent in the landscape of E3?
Well, actually, I mean, this is the sort of glorious irony of E3 as it exists today. While it's set up to shift these enormous big budget blockbusters, there is, you know, as I said, there's this sense of fear and trepidation in the industry. Where you get a game like Destiny that has a budget of $500 million, they can't really, although they're talking about innovation, it's mostly innovation on the kind of infrastructure side, so it makes interesting use of cloud-based servers. There's a lot of fear about, oh God, what do people want? How do we innovate in this industry? And what they're increasingly doing is looking at the indie sector and looking at these very small studios that are making niche games which are finding their audiences out there. You know, Minecraft is the obvious example of something which has come from the indie sector and has exploded, and everybody wants to see if they can somehow grasp that. So actually, yes, there is a space for indie games, and both Sony and Microsoft put aside really quite large chunks of their big press conferences before the event talking about big indie games that are coming up. Sony, for example, ran a really long trailer of a really beautiful space exploration game called No Man's Sky, which is by the Guildford studio Hello Games, which is like four or five people. It's doing really interesting things with technology that you couldn't do with like a multi-million dollar production. At the Microsoft show, Phil Spencer, the head of Xbox, really raved about the latest game from the makers of a cult title called Limbo, which was kind of like an underground hit on Xbox Live Arcade a few years ago. And it's a new game called Inside, and it's all kind of grim or Orwellian visuals. And lots of niche, interesting ideas. So I think the industry is saying we're spending money on these big sequels, and that's what we need to do in a way, but where are the next generation of ideas coming from? So yes, there is room for indie. There is room for indie, very much. Everybody's almost relying on indie to sort of innovate. People are sort of almost kind of outsourcing innovation to the indie sector. So my first appointment at E3 actually today is going to be Indiecade, which is an organization that represents and kind of helps indie developers. And they've got a big showing on the show floor at E3. And all the executives from like Sega, Nintendo, Sony will go to the Indiecade sector of E3, and they'll be picking up ideas, and they'll be talking, they'll be handing out business cards to these young kids.
You've not mentioned one of the big three that are in this space, and sounds to me like Nintendo is not a presence at E3.
They are there. Interestingly, obviously Wii U has struggled, and Nintendo decided to not hold their traditional press conference on the Tuesday morning, the first day of E3 proper. Instead, they're doing a Nintendo Direct live webcast to talk about their latest games. Nintendo have really, really struggled, except very recently, Mario Kart 8 has just come out, and sales of Wii U have boosted dramatically. That's not really much to say because they were so low to begin with, but I think Nintendo's approach, philosophy of game design is very much kind of perfection and reliable brands that everybody knows, and it hasn't worked on Wii U because people don't really understand what Wii U is offering. They don't really understand this idea of having a second screen in front of them. So Nintendo is definitely here. I think they've got some interesting announcements coming up, and they've got big games like Super Smash Brothers, which is a really popular series. I think this E3 for them is going to be about trying to reestablish that relationship with their hardcore user base again, trying to get people back on board. This is very much a kind of let's rediscover what it is that people love about Nintendo, and let's try and give that back to them.
Keith, I have a more of a personal question, and it doesn't have anything to do with Grim Fandango. I have to say, I am quite excited about that. I have to say, and it's something that has always rankled me when I was a games journalist. It was the thing that actually I got attacked the most for, which was an announcement that E3 was no longer going to allow booth babes. I'm wondering if the booth babes are back, and how it feels at a trade show and at a consumer show to have such a presence. Is this a kind of, you know, is the programmer culture, is it there as well?
I think there's always going to be a little bit of that booth babe culture. It's very much downplayed now, and most of the publishers will have like more like cosplay models on their stands, so they'll have people dressed as characters from their games rather than just women parading around in bikinis. That side of the industry has kind of is kind of disappearing. There is still, you know, you cannot get away from the fact that E3 is predominantly men. You know, out of the 40,000 people that go, I would say, you know, a good 80% of them, probably even more, are men. And there is still that sense of a show, a big exhibition, has to have that, you know, that element of quote unquote glamour. But that's definitely not as much the case anymore. That is reducing into the past. There is a real sense that the industry has to change the way it thinks about a wider, you know, demographic of people, and that includes, bizarrely, you know, 51% of the population. So a few months before E3 every year, we have the Game Developers Conference in San Francisco, and that has really worked on issues of gender and inclusivity across the board. And I think that has kind of filtered into the mainstream industry. There is this sense that You cannot exist on that hardcore young teen male demographic anymore. You have to appear to be an industry which is respectful and all-encompassing. So it's very unlikely and it's very rare these days to actually see booth babes parading around.
I, for one, am thrilled. And you can read up on all of Keith's coverage of E3. And do, please, send him some love, folks. He's working really hard out there at theguardian.com/games. Keith, thank you very much.
Okay, thanks very much, Alex.
All right, take care. That's all we have for you this week. But from me, Alex Kratosky, and producer Jason Phipps, and of course, all the tech team, thanks for listening.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.